If you want to learn more about the topics of today's episode, visit the podcast website at naturesecretservice.com. Thanks for listening. This is Nature's Secret Service, the podcast that puts you in the room with the men and women of wildlife law enforcement. Welcome to this week's episode. I'm Ed Newcomer, your host. This week, I'm super happy to welcome Keith Swindle, former special agent with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and biologist by education and prior experience. Keith, when he became a special agent for the Fish and Wildlife Service, he was immediately sent to our Sacramento, California field office, but was quickly recruited to go work in Honolulu, Hawaii, where he was a field agent there and eventually made his way up to resident agent in charge of all of the Hawaiian Islands district there, which Pacific district really, which includes Hawaii, Guam, American Samoa, Northern Marianas, and all of the U.S. possessions in the Pacific. So a big area that he was in charge of for a while. He also did a stint at headquarters as what's called a desk agent, which means he was a special agent that worked at our headquarters office and served as a wildlife law enforcement attaché in Africa, covering all of the countries in the Horn of Africa, which basically made him senior most diplomatic representative of the service in that part of Africa. So there's a lot we can talk about with Keith. But today we're going to talk about a really interesting case he did while he was in Hawaii that actually, honestly, I've been dying to talk to him about in some capacity in a public forum for a long time. So, Keith, welcome to the podcast. I really appreciate you being here. You are coming to us remotely from your house in Northern California, but thank you so much for making the time to be here.
Hey, Ed, thanks a lot. I really appreciate it, and I'm excited to be on.
You know, one thing I forgot to mention in your stellar background is since you retired from the Fish and Wildlife Service about a year ago, you're now the executive director of the Audubon Society for Hawaii, which is absolutely the perfect fit for you. I was so happy to hear that news. So congratulations. That's great.
Yeah, thanks. I'm excited for that too. And I've just been doing that for a month or two and it's been a lot of fun. And I'm having to kind of commute back and forth right now because we have some issues here going on in the mainland.
That's a tough job to have to commute back and forth between Northern California and Hawaii.
I'm used to these really difficult locations like, you know, Nairobi, Kenya and Honolulu.
Right. You definitely suffered in your career, didn't you?
I have.
we've talked about this, you and I, before, because we've known each other our whole careers as agents, and we're friends. You know, one of the cool things about being an agent with the Fish and Wildlife Service is historically there's a pretty diverse background among agents, particularly over the last, you know, maybe 25 years or so. And your background, you were a biologist and did a lot of endangered species work in the northwestern part of the U.S. before you were hired as an agent. What drew you to wanting to come over to law enforcement from a biologist background?
Yeah, you know, I was recruited by an agent. What happened was, and this is along these lines, like you and I have discussed in the past, you know, it's such a cool thing that we've had people with diverse backgrounds, because that background really drives what you do as an agent, you know, and really informs that. And that was really true for me, because I was, as you mentioned, a wildlife biologist and a researcher in Oregon. And I had a background in northern spotted owls. I did a decade of research. I led a few research programs on that, worked for the Oregon Cooperative Wildlife Research Unit at that time. And because of that background, somebody that knew me that was working for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service recruited me to become an expert witness, because unbeknownst to me, well, I knew that these cases were going on, but I didn't know anything about the special agents that were doing them in the Pacific Northwest. And basically, those agents needed expert testimony in some of the cases that they were doing on forest birds like the northern spotted owl and marbled murrelet. And so I was hired to the Fish and Wildlife Service as a biologist to provide that expertise. And I did that for a couple of years. And then the agent came to me one day and he said, you know, do you know how you go into these meetings as a biologist and and you go into some company that, you know, that is violating maybe the Endangered Species Act, and you tell them what they ought to do to comply with the law. And then when you walk out of the room, you feel their middle fingers go up behind your back. And he said, as an agent, if you had a badge and a gun, that's a very different experience, those types of meetings. And I actually got to see that directly. 100%. Yeah. And my first meeting of the same exact kind of meeting as an agent with a badge on my belt, you know, and a sidearm, instead of maybe just having a consultant with the company, like a biological consultant that I would meet with, suddenly, you know, it's the CEO, it's legal counsel, sometimes right. some extra legal counsel from the outside, and then they're maybe their consultant biologist who would sit, you know, in the corner and not say anything. You know, so it was it really was a different thing, and that's kind of what drew me in, because when I was a researcher, I felt like I was ultimately, when I was doing endangered species work, I felt kind of like, to look really cynically at it, like I was documenting the demise of species. Mm. And when I became a Fish and Wildlife Service biologist, I was essentially a regulator, you know, and,
yep.
And then after just a couple of years of that, I really felt like, you know, I'm just kind of regulating my species. And
you're giving advice.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And then, so the thing that appealed to me, and this is the way that agent that recruited me, named Pete Nylander, he said, you know, you went from essentially documenting their demise to regulating their demise. Now you can actually do something about their demise if you, you know, nice. Work for us with the Fish and Wildlife Service Office of Law Enforcement. And I felt like that's what got me over the edge. You know, I never had a desire to be in law enforcement, but that's what right. put me over.
Sometimes yeah. those turn out to be the best agents, are the ones who'd have never picked up a gun in their life before, and you just train them the way you want to train them. And you know, they bring a different background and mindset to the whole thing. I had so many similar experiences in Southern California when I was an agent there. I don't know how you handled it, but whenever I would have those meetings with the corporations or, you know, maybe the municipalities or the, you know, local governments or whatever that were violating Endangered Species Act or some other law, I always made a special point to wear that, you know, yeah. plain black suit with the white shirt and the plain tie. And then I'd go into the conference room and very casually take off my jacket, make sure they saw the gun and they saw the badge on my belt. And yeah, the attitude and the response you get from corporate violators changes dramatically. And I've said this so many times in so many settings, you know, I'll say it again, and anybody who watches or listens to this podcast is going to get tired of hearing it. But I don't know if you ever heard this, but one of the great quotes from Abraham Lincoln is that the law without enforcement is nothing more than good advice. Yeah. And that is so true. When a biologist is telling you, hey, this shouldn't be done, that's advice. When a law enforcement officer sitting in the room, a special agent with the federal government, is telling you, hey, you guys are violating the law, That's a different message for sure, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm gonna throw you under your own bus here, because I remember about 20 years ago, you and I were talking about that quote, because I think I may have had it in a talk or something that you saw it, or I don't know how it came up.
Oh, did I steal it from you?
I don't know. Or I might have gotten it from you, but what I remember is this conversation, because this blew me away and this says a lot about you. You went to the Library of Congress, I believe, to find out the origin of that quote, and to try to get the original quotation. And I can't remember what you found. You found that it was attributed to Abraham Lincoln, but there was no documented record or something like that. Is that
something
right?
Something like that. Yeah. 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 And that all came about because there were some people who were attributing that quote to a very well-known, very well-respected assistant U.S. attorney. And I was like, no, I don't think the U.S. attorney said that. I think a president of the United States said that. And you know me, I was determined to go find out exactly where that quote came from.
I think we probably both got it. Was that Bob Anderson or John Webb?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
That was at Bob Anderson. Yeah.
Yeah. Bob,
very, very well-respected and kind of famous. I won't say infamous. He was a famous U.S. attorney who worked on wildlife cases.
Yeah.
So this actually leads in perfectly to the discussion I want to have with you today. And just if we go long, Keith, we'll just turn this into a two-parter. But so I don't want you to feel like you're rushed to tell the story, because this is a good one. But, we're going to talk today about a bird, which, you know, perfect that you worked previously on spotted owl stuff. And I want you to tell us about that bird in a second. But mostly... right now, I want to ask you the hard-hitting question. Why do you hate high school football so much?
That's a low blow.
All right, so you don't have to answer, because we're going to get into the answer to that question. But for right now, you know exactly what I'm talking about. For right now, tell us, what is a Newell's Shearwater bird? It's a bird. What's a Newell's Shearwater?
Yeah. And for the record, I love football. The Newell Shearwater is one of a couple of species that almost no one knows anything about, and it's a species of seabird that is endemic to the Hawaiian Islands. In other words, it's found nowhere else on Earth. And another species called the Hawaiian petrel is also endemic to the Hawaiian Islands, and they're kind of similar in a couple of respects. And one of the amazing things, and this is exactly where what we were talking about, you know, because of my background, I was recruited specifically to work this case, and that was. So I was recruited because I knew stuff about spotted owls, and I became an agent. But on the hiring panel of the, you know, the agents that interviewed us when we applied for our job,
right,
was an agent named Paul Chang, and Paul is a native Hawaiian, and he was on the panel. And because I was one of the few biologists that was hired in my cohort. And I had purely like an endangered species enforcement and regulatory background. Paul right. called me up when I was in Sacramento, as in my first duty station. And he said, I really want you to go to Hawaii. I really want you to consider to transfer to Hawaii. And I did ultimately, and he tasked me with this case about the Newell Shearwater. And another pivotal person, unbeknownst to me, but a friend of mine that I knew in the spotted owl work, was a solicitor for Department of Interior named Steve Siegel. And Steve saw a kind of a standard report come out of the Hawaii Office of of the Fish and Wildlife Service that mentioned that since 1979, and this was probably like around 2000, the year 2000, since 1979 to 2000, over 30,000 Newell shearwaters were grounded. In other words, they were taken from the sky, more or less, for various reasons, and then retrieved and many of them released. And Steve Siegel, being an attorney, was like, well, wait a minute, that's a threatened species under the Endangered Species Act, and it's a migratory bird under the Migratory Bird Treaty Act. And when he found out why they were being grounded, it was all human causes. So that was, as you know, what we would call take under the Endangered Species Act. And right. So Steve, like I said, it was kind of like a routine report coming through, and these reports were coming through every year, but it took Steve to see it and recognize, well, wait a minute, what is this? And it turns out, you know, it's probably the largest take of a single land animal species, you know. When I say land animal, you know, the shearwaters, I'm talking like a vertebrate, you know, not a fish. Well, I mean, a land right. vertebrate, you know, not a fish or not an insect right. or something like that, that have high numbers.
Right.
I mean, I can't think of another incident where there's been 30,000 of one species that's on the Endangered Species Act that was taken due to humans, that wasn't a fish or something like that.
Right. Right. So the Newell shearwater, and what we'll try to do here is I'll get some photos of the Newell shearwater and the petrel, and we'll put them on the Nature Secret Service website so people can go see what these things look like.
Yeah.
But basically, when you talk about grounded, there's a couple things I want to talk about here. One is the law, but the other is when you talk about grounded, I think it would help people understand what that means, really, if you kind of describe, you know, the habits or the behaviors of Newell shearwaters and petrels. How do they, you know, what's their process of fledging their chicks, and what do you mean by grounded?
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, even though I was a certified wildlife biologist, you know, I had never heard of a Newell shearwater when I went to Hawaii in about the year 2001. And so what I'll do is I'll tell you exactly your question is exactly the initiation of the process I had to go through to figure this out, because basically Paul Chang, who, you know, Steve Siegel said to Paul Chang, look at this problem. Paul Chang knew about the problem from when he was a kid in Hawaii, and he really wanted somebody to fix that. And so that's what he tasked me with doing. And so I moved there, I moved there basically with this commission, you know, you gotta fix this problem. And so
nice, all by yourself, by the way, right?
Yeah. So what I did is I went around, you know, I mean, just being a biologist, I knew I needed to find the people that knew about the birds, you know, and I found the other biologists, the researchers, the state biologists, the federal biologists, the university researchers that had been doing these studies. And we knew, you know, this data that over 30,000 had been grounded, you know, came from somewhere, right? So I went and found those people and talked to them. And the Newell shearwater
grounded, you mean basically they were flying and something, for some reason, they were knocked out of the air, not of their own choice, right?
Exactly.
And they either come down and they're injured, killed, or...
Yeah.
They just
yeah.
can't get back in the air by themselves. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. And so Newell shearwaters and Hawaiian petrels are types of seabirds that they kind of need a long runway to get going, you know, in terms of flight. And so if you, unlike a mallard, you know, like a duck that can jump from the water into the air, these right. would be more like some of the diving ducks that have to run along the surface of the water before they can get airborne. Got
So
it. Shearwaters and petrels need a little bit of runway. And so where that's meaningful is that if they've come out of the sky for some reason onto the land, they either need a drop off or a clear runway or a real strong headwind and a combination of a drop off to get airborne.
Right.
And these two species probably what few people realize these days is that seabirds for the Hawaiian Islands and the whole Hawaiian archipelago, seabirds were what I would consider the buffalo of those islands in terms of being foundational species to that tropical island ecosystem. Like buffalo are that foundational species to the Great Plains, at one time. And we're starting now to
Interesting.
recognize that role that buffalo played in the Great Plains and in the prairies and grasslands. Seabirds were that for tropical islands. These islands had no mammals whatsoever on the land. There was with the exception of a small bat and a monk seal, that came as far as
Right.
the beach. But on land, there were no mammals. There were tons and tons of bird species, especially, and the ones that I think were foundational were the seabirds for this reason. The Hawaiian Islands were volcanoes that popped up out of the middle of the ocean. So
Right.
imagine an eruption and this volcano appears, and what you have is nothing but rock. 2,000
It's a rock.
miles, a couple thousand miles away from any continent. And the
Right.
only thing, if you think about creating soil out of rock, the only things we have are wind and rain and sun. But then if you add in seabirds that would colonize the island, they would bring tons of nutrients to these islands. And
Right.
if you imagine a volcano in the middle of the ocean that's bare rock, and then you populate that with almost two dozen species of seabirds in their millions,
Right.
from beach to mountaintop. And then those seabirds are making daily flights out to catch squid and fish and other things in the ocean. And then they come back and they defecate. And all birds defecate and urinate pretty much at the same time. So there's
Right.
uric acid when they defecate, so they like add a little bit of acid and a bunch of nutrients, and that acid helps the rain break down volcanic rock. So in
Fascinating.
yeah, so if you and then you compound this out over time, basically we owe seabirds the fact that we have soil, on a
Right,
lot of these
right.
islands.
Right.
So really a critical component to the ecology of the islands. And that was true of a bunch of different species. So now back to your original
So
question,
cool.
what's unique about the Newell shearwater and the Hawaiian petrel is that there were two of the seabird species that could breed way up in the mountains. So,
Okay.
which is in itself just incredible, because you imagine you're at, on the ocean in Hawaii, and
Right.
it's 85 degrees or something like that. And then you fly up to like 10,000 feet on top of one of the islands, like the Big Island or on Maui, maybe even higher than that. And then that's where your
Right.
nest is, and it's sub-zero at night, or I mean sub-freezing at night at least, maybe in the 20 degrees.
Right.
And then to feed your chick, if you're the Hawaiian petrel, for example, you're going to fly almost to California or to the Aleutian Islands. And in one feeding trip, like you go out, you catch fish up in,
Wow.
south of Alaska, and then you fly all the way back to your nest 10,000 feet up on this volcano. It's just,
That's crazy.
it is crazy. It is crazy. So anyway, that's some of the cool stuff about those birds, but they are nocturnal when they go to nest. So the only time that they come to land is as the sun is setting and after dark. And I don't entirely understand why that is. There may have been some ancient predator in the daytime that's extinct now that maybe made them that way, but for whatever reason, they come in at night and they also leave at night, or leave before daylight. So to go out to sea. And what happens is for both species, they raise one chick in this hole in the ground up high in these mountains, or in these, some of which are forested and some are just barren, looking like Mars, like up on Mauna Loa, for example. And when it's barren, they're nesting in like a little lava tube or a little crevice or something under the rocks so they can get some shade. When it's vegetated, they might burrow down into the soil or the roots of plants, or even on the surface under plants. And then they raise this one chick, starting in like early, late spring, and then that one chick is their, their only egg is literally in one basket. And then come October, those chicks mature enough to make their maiden voyage out to sea. And they have one shot at it. They're not like a lot of other birds where they can try to fly and then fail and then perch somewhere and then get fed again and that sort of thing. They have to wait till they can
So they're
actually,
gonna they're gonna launch off their cliffside nest, and if they don't make it, they ain't taking off again, basically, right?
exactly. And so they get airborne often by climbing. They'll literally climb trees, they'll climb brush, they'll climb rocks, and then they'll get a little bit of height that way. And if the wind is right, they'll launch, and then they're airborne. And that
And this is
flight,
at night, right?
and that flight, they have to make it to the ocean. If they don't make it to the ocean, they're pretty much toast. So what we think happens is they navigate by moonlight and starlight, and they fly out toward the ocean. So this flight could be, from the center of these islands, it might be, 10, 12 miles or just a couple miles. But anything in their way is a problem. And so, as they come down, if they're going to hit, if there's power lines in their way that they can't see in time, and they have good night vision, but not, perfect. And bear in mind, it's their first flight. They're not that
Never flown
great
before.
at maneuvering. And then the one phenomenon which causes what we call this grounding or fallout, we would call it fallout, is light attraction. So like a moth to a light, Newell shearwaters, and some other seabirds that are nocturnal, will see a light and they'll start to circle it. And so these are unshielded lights. And you have to think about a light, like if you're looking at a street light, if you are above the level of the light and you can see the light bulb itself shining in your eyes, that's an unshielded light. It's a light that's shining skyward in addition to downward.
Rather than straight down,
And exactly. If you have a shielded light, a fully shielded light, as soon as you're at the same level as the base of the fixture, like let's say a light pole on or a street light, as soon as you're up at the same level, you can't see the light bulb anymore. So the light is all directed
Interesting.
downward. And if you're flying, and I took this photo a long time ago from this seabird colony, a Newell shearwater colony. I was up in the mountains, and it was sunset. And after the sunset, I'm looking out over the island, and here is this beacon of light, like just. And I'm at like 4 or 5,000 feet elevation, well, 3 or 4,000 feet elevation. And, I see this light down by essentially down by the beach or down by the city near the beach. And what that was a football stadium. So yeah, that's kind of the issue. So if they start circling the light, they basically get tired. And then they fall down, they hit the ground, and then they're either nailed by a cat, a dog, these are invasive species to Hawaii, or cars, or they're in a location where they can't get airborne again because it's relatively flat. And if they're in a area where there's not enough wind and not enough space, they can't get off the ground again, and then they're susceptible to even rats and cats and things like that. Or they just get dehydrated and
And
die.
yeah, I was just going to say dehydrated. They're not eating. They're expended all their energy. Their life's short at that point.
Yeah. So when I said that we knew that there were like 30,000 that had done that was years of collection by the public of these birds that grounded themselves, and people found them. And there was this guy named Tom Telfer. Long time ago, and some of his colleagues and associates, another guy named Thomas Kaiakapu. Those guys had this program called Save Our Shearwaters on the island of Kauai. And so if you imagine the island is basically a circular island, just imagine more or less a volcano, with a caldera kind of broken off and eroded. But the road goes about, 80% around the outer edge of the island. There's essentially a road along, parallel to the beaches all the way around. And there's little communities all the way around that road. And in each community, there's a fire station. And at each fire station, they would put what looks like a apartment building mix made out of kind of like milk crate material, the old plastic milk crates. And each one of these mailboxes might have maybe like 12 compartments and a little door on it. And you would take your shearwater, which is about the size, a little bit bigger than a pigeon, and you open the door and stick it in a slot and then leave it. And so
So if the public's out and comes across a downed, grounded shearwater, and it's alive, they can take it to their local fire station and essentially somebody will take care of it, try to get it back to the wild. Is that the idea? That
It
is
is
so
really
cool.
cool. The thing is, and a lot of the criticism I got early on was, well, look at all these people are doing all these good things, and they would take the what would happen to the bird you put in the box at night is the next morning a biologist from the state would come around and collect the birds and then release them out at the beach, And the problem is that they found since 1979 to 2000, they found 30,000. How many did they not find, and how many were dead? When they found them. And then sometimes when the guy would come in the morning, the bird would, had sat there all night. So the lucky ones get found by a person and taken, and put in this box. But some of them, a good percentage, would die overnight, of dehydration or whatever. And then the ones that are being released, there's no they're being just released in whatever condition they are. Sometimes they couldn't even leave the beach. They wouldn't fly. They'd just end up dying there. And then what about all those, tens of thousands undoubtedly that were never found? So that's kind of the scenario that had been occurring.
Yeah. So now is a good time to make sure that everybody understands the law. Cause I can just imagine there's a lot of people like, yeah, so what's a special agent involved here for and why? So you already mentioned, shearwaters and petrels are both listed under the Migratory Bird Treaty Act, which is a federal law that prohibits the take of any bird listed under that act. I'll just give a quick rundown, yeah. Keith, and correct me if I get anything wrong. But with the MBTA, that's an old federal statute, and it's a good one, because it's basically a strict liability law. So you know, if you it doesn't matter if you set out to kill a bird or you intentionally did something that killed a bird, you kill a bird on the list, and technically you violated it. That's strict liability. But the shearwater, the Newell shearwater, is listed also under the Endangered Species Act as threatened. Is the petrel
is actually listed as endangered. Yeah.
Oh, it's endangered. Okay. So that's a different level of protection. And taking, killing, capturing, doing anything that harms them is considered take, can be a criminal violation, but there has to be some type of either, you know, intent there somehow involved. Either you intentionally set out to do it, or you were told, hey, this behavior is resulting in take, and then you don't change that behavior. So that turns into you're intentionally acting now, right? And, you know, businesses can get tangled up in this, right? So you mentioned, you know, how the birds see lights as maybe they confuse it with stars or moons. You know, in Southern California, when they started to build all of these solar fields, right under the Pacific Flyway, which is a major migration route for migratory birds, what we started to see out in California was at night, water birds, waterfowl, geese, ducks, loons, whatever, mergansers would be flying, and they would see these solar fields reflecting in the starlight or the moonlight, and they would think it was a lake. Mm-hmm. And they'd come down to land on this lake, and they hit the panels and they kill themselves in the thousands, right? So the question is, you know, the company that puts up the lights, or the company that puts up the solar panels or the wind turbines, they may not know at the time. They probably should if they did their due diligence with their biologists ahead of time. But they may not have known that they were building right under a major flyway. Mm-hmm. And so then the question becomes, they start to kill birds unintentionally. They never set out to do that. Obviously, they're just trying to provide light or generate power. But as these birds start to get killed, particularly in high numbers, it goes way beyond incidental take. And it could actually impact the population. So what normally happens is the company is advised, usually by that biologist, like Keith Swindle was before he became an agent, says, hey, you're killing a lot of birds out here, right? And here's some things you might do to minimize that, or to stop it, or to reduce it dramatically. And then at that point, if the company, whether it's SoCal Edison or a power company or a private business that owns these wind turbines, if they don't change the way they operate their equipment in a way that reduces their numbers of killed, then essentially they're intentionally violating the ESA, Endangered Species Act. I just wanted to kind of cut through the explanation, because sometimes I think people, they don't really understand, well, so somebody built solar power, that's a good thing. Why would that company be potentially criminally liable for killing wildlife? And it's not that simple, you know. There are a lot of things these companies know ahead of time about where they're building, and there's a lot of things they know that they could do to reduce deaths or eliminate deaths, but it costs money, and they don't want to do it. And so they just hope that they're not going to get in trouble. I mean, is that a fair explanation of kind of where you were with shearwaters when
absolutely.
You got there?
Absolutely, yeah. And, you know, along those lines, you know, some of the this is not the right term. What some of those that are that were responsible for the particular lights that were causing this to happen and the particular power lines, you know, they were early on kind of involved in the Save Our Shearwater program, more or less passively, you know, often. In other words, like the state biologist might say, you know, I want to do this Save Our Shearwaters program. They might give them a little money to buy the milk crate material or something like that. or they might contribute in other ways, maybe publicize it or something, because this is only happening every October and November. And only during the new, well, primarily during the new moon phase of October and the new moon phase of November. That's when the fledging season for these species was. And so, you know, there was these efforts, mostly voluntary efforts by not necessarily the people that were doing that had the facilities that were harming these species, but you know, they were supportive, you know, just generally supportive, but really not taking the, you know, responsibility to make things better, in my view. And, you know,
right.
Throughout my career, and you know, you've raised this really interesting, almost dilemma, right? Where if somebody is basically causing, unintentionally causing, you know, the demise of a species through whatever their facility is or whatever their action is, then how punitive do we want to be against them, you know? And then right. How do we bring them into quote unquote compliance where they're no longer doing that? And you know, the sad reality of humans is like, and just like our favorite quote, you know, without enforcement, the law is just advice, you know?
Absolutely.
And
yeah. And often when financial interests compete with advice, financial interests win.
Yeah.
Right?
I used to, when I would, when I would give my talks and I would use that quote, I used to say, you know, from a financial perspective, it's arguably bad advice. You know,
right,
the law is
true.
Arguably bad advice.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. And, but you know, it's, you know, we could go off on a whole tangent about, you know, criminal justice education and criminal justice concepts. But one of the things that I think is so cool about living in a democratic society is that it essentially the citizens of the United States give their permission to have law enforcement officers enforce the law against them, right?
Yeah.
Like the only reason a law enforcement officer has authority to make an arrest is because voters gave them permission to use force if necessary to enforce the law.
Yeah.
And that, you know, a non-democratic country, that is not true. And we can change it too. So, you know, if you just look at marijuana laws 20 years ago, you could have gotten arrested for having marijuana. In many states now it's legal. And that's because voters decided they wanted it to be legal. And when they do, the cops won't arrest you for it anymore. Mm-hmm. Right. And so as a society, we make a choice. We want to protect these animals. We do not want Newell Shearwaters to go extinct. So yeah, we're going to have to, there's going to be a financial burden that's going to have to come with that. And it's not a huge one, but that's what we decided. Well, and so that's what the law enforcement officers are going to do.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And so because of this kind of, you know, I use the word dilemma, I didn't go out and say, you know, look, you're violating the law. You're under arrest. We're going to jail right now. You know, what I did is I spent, I spent about 8 years of educating, you know, basically finding all the locations. So for over a 10 year period.
Oh yeah.
Oh, go ahead.
So wait, we got to back up for just a second because we got to talk about something really important that you bring to the table when you come into this case. And that is what has been going on before has been efforts of biologists and the local community who want to save these birds. And it's been very ad hoc grassroots. Yeah, we found this many and, you know, we don't really know what happened to the others. And now as a special agent from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, you arrive on scene now and you are going to bring a law enforcement perspective to this. And so just, you know, what does that mean? Like what is the arrival of a special agent from U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service change versus what's been going on before?
Yeah.
It's really documentation,
yeah,
right?
Something that I call it the fragile coalition. So, and what I mean by that is you as an agent, you show up, and then there's this whole community of people that are saying, you know, the status quo is good enough. And we are all volunteering, we're all working, and we're, you know, this all is great. We pick up all these birds. Look at all these birds we picked up and we've released. How great is that? And I'm sitting there looking at it like, yeah, but how many have you missed? Why are they coming down in the first place? That's a violation of law. And just trying to do essentially, basically putting a Band-Aid on the skin cancer is not, you know, a solution.
Right.
And and my mentor agent, Pete Nylander, the guy that recruited me originally, used to have this saying, and he said, you know, you have to break eggs to make an omelet. And nobody wants to break eggs, you know? So basically, right, you have to come in as the agent and kind of like, just, you know, break those eggs. And then, you know, and that's by enforcing the law, and the eggs represent like the fragile coalition that everybody is. It's just the status quo. It's the norm. You know, it's the way we've been getting by all this time without anybody complaining.
Meanwhile, all your shearwaters are disappearing, right?
Yeah.
And even, you know, I know how much you love football, but we're going to explain how even in the Friday night football games on Kauai, the football players themselves were able to document the demise of their own species. We're going to talk about that later. Don't forget. But, you know, what you're doing differently than what the community did before is you're coming over now as an agent, and you're saying, hey, is a crime occurring? And if so, that's something that potentially is going to get charged. And now there's a whole different level. If you're going to charge a company or a person or whatever with violating the law, there's a process that has to be done. There has to be a very neutral, fair, complete professional investigation done. And that's what you bring to the table when you arrive in Kauai.
Right.
You're going to investigate this case, right?
Yeah.
Which means documenting the who, what, where, when, and why, and how.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So.
So.
Yeah. So I spent.
Yeah, go ahead.
10 years of nights in October and November.
And that that is the craziest part of this. And there's a reason for the 10 years. And when listeners hear why it took you 10 years, why you worked on this case for 10 years, it will change their whole perspective about how they view law enforcement and in particular federal agents, because we get a bad reputation sometimes for being heavy-handed, too aggressive, and it's always the bad guys who accuse us of those things. But there's a reason it took you 10 years to do this, and we are going to have to talk about that in the next episode, because this is going to be a two-parter, because this is too good. So right now, we're going to wrap up this episode, and I'm going to tell you, join us next week, because Keith is going to tell you why it took 10 years to work on this case and the fabulous outcome that resulted. So thank you very much for tuning in to Nature Secret Service for this week. We'll see you next time. Nature Secret Service is written and produced by me, Ed Newcomer, and is co-produced by the DHTV team here at California State University, Dominguez Hills. Follow us on social media and connect with us online at naturesecretservice.com.